I tried to go home with him. When he ran after his mother and grabbed her extended hand, I ran too and grabbed the other hand. She didn't push me away. She didn't say, "Don't touch me." It was then that the woman realized for the first time that I was alone. "Where do you live?" she'd asked, and I asked instead if I could go home with them. She told me no, but her eyes were kind and attentive, and yet hoping like some little lost puppy that I'd just go home. It wasn't the only time something like this happened. "Eat," Ingrid says to me, staring down at the table of food set before us, and, "Please, there's too much for me. I can't let it go to waste." "You will stay, won't you, Alex?" she asks with a bit of humble supplication as I stand before the kitchen table, eyes on the food she set out before me, quite certain I drool like a hungry dog. Looking into her eyes, I'm reminded again how sad they are. Ingrid has sad eyes, lonely eyes. She blames the wasted food for the reason I should stay, and yet the real reason is this. She's alone. She has no one to talk to, no one other than the celebs on TV to share this meal with her, and a one-way conversation with the television set is more than just sad and lonely. It's pathetic. And so I sit, and I eat. I eat the pasta first, followed by peach cobbler with vanilla ice cream on the side. I'm cajoled into a game of gin rummy. It's so hard to say no to Ingrid, and as time goes on, I find that I don't want to. I don't want to go. Before I know it, Ingrid and I are watching the TV from where we sit, at the kitchen table, with our dinner dishes cast aside to the edge, old Jeopardy reruns, and we're calling out the answers in tandem. "Who is Burt Reynolds?" she exclaims, and me to the next question, "What is Provence?" And then she reaches for a deck of cards and starts to deal. 10 for me, 10 for her. This is what it feels like to be part of a family. Most of my evenings I spend alone. Well, not really alone, but rather with Pops, which is essentially the equivalent to being alone. We sit in the same room sometimes, but we never talk, and sometimes we don't even sit in the same room. Friends are gone, girlfriends are nil. I, like Ingrid, spend my evenings in the company of the TV when I'm not following the town shrink home from work or sneaking my way into an abandoned home. I offer to stay and help with the dishes after Jeopardy and Gin Rummy are through. Ingrid tries hard to refuse. "You're my guest," she says, but I insist, standing before the stainless steel sink, watching as it fills with opalescent dish soap bubbles, which I pop one by one with an index finger, and then I submerge the dishes and start to wash. In the drying rack, the dishes quickly accumulate and clatter, a tower of saturated dishes amassing quickly, so that when I set another on top, they slip, threatening to fall. "Where are the dish towels?" I ask Ingrid, rummaging through the kitchen drawers to find something to dry the dishes with. But Ingrid says no. "Let them be," she says, telling me they'll air dry overnight. "You work too hard," she says, adding then, "You're a good boy, Alex. You know that, don't you?" I see it then, the gradient of the skin around her eyes, the thinning, puckering skin, the dullness of her irises, the redness of the sclera, conjunctivitis, I think, pink eye, allergies, or maybe just someone who is sad. I nod my head and say yes, I know that, though sometimes I'm not so sure if it's true. Good or not good, I still feel like a deadbeat. It's that thought that haunts me in the middle of the night, the fact that this is the be-all and end-all of life for me. This is it, life as I know it, that there will never be anything other than this, This town, this existence, Pretty's Cafe. A lifetime of cleaning up someone else's dirty dishes. I hear the girl from my dreams calling to me. Let's go. Will I ever get the chance to go? Your mother, she says, allowing her voice to drift off before finding the guts to finish the thought, to say what she's thinking out loud. She should have known better than to leave. And then she pats me on the arm as I turn to go, carrying with me a container of leftover pasta. As I walk, off in the distance a coyote howls as the train rattles through town, a freight train this time, too late for the commuter train to be coming through. But it did pass through, hours ago, that commuter train. I wonder if Pearl climbed on board, or whether she is still here, patrolling the streets of town. It's well after 9 o'clock, and the town is in a deep sleep, hibernating, as we do, until spring. When I get home, Pops is sound asleep on the sofa, face down. Beside his overturned beer is another final notice, moist with the fermenting scent of alcohol. It clings to the table, threatening to tear as I lift it up and curse out loud. Damn it, Pops. The electricity this time. Soon we will be without lights. My eyes skim past the TV, past the lamp, past an ugly old flush mount light on the living room ceiling, and to the open refrigerator door. All on, all being used. He's managed to leave them all on, amassing more charges on the bill. I'm going to have to work overtime to pay the bill, more time busting my ass for Pretty while Pop sits at home getting trashed, and the money he gets for the beer. Now there's the real kicker. Pops doesn't have his own money for beer. He smashed my piggy bank once upon a time, long ago, when I was just a boy. He's been known to find and forge my paychecks from Pretty, and has asked at the bank for them to be cashed. Then he started sneaking into my bedroom and stealing my things, old baseball trophies, my high school class ring, stuff he could sell at the thrift store in town. Now I keep him on a small allowance so that he'll leave my things be. But still, he doesn't leave them be. Just last week I discovered my telescope missing, another treasure sold for booze. But these are just things to me. Material things. What matters most to me isn't worth more than a few bucks, but I keep it tucked away under my bed to be sure Pops never finds it. My collection of crinoid stems. Indian beads gathered from the seashore. Tiny fossilized creatures collected in a Ziploc bag. Pops can have the telescope if he needs it that badly, but the crinoid stems are mine. As expected, a single stove burner has been left on, the house filling quickly with a kerosene-like smell. A grilled cheese, completely blackened, lies forgotten on the stove, burning on a frying pan while Pops sleeps and snores, runnels of drool trickling down his chin and onto a slothful hand. The butter has been left out of the refrigerator, on the countertop beside the pack of American cheese. Both look a little bit gamey to me. I toss them in the trash. The fridge door is wide open, the food inside drifting to lukewarm. There's a spilled beer on the floor, the brew seeping into the tiles of our kitchen floor, warping them before my eyes. I try to shake him awake and get him to clean his own goddamn mess. He doesn't budge. I press my ear to his chest to be sure. He's still breathing. He better be. This way I can kill him when he finally does wake up. He could have burned the whole house down. I open the windows to air out the stench and put myself to work cleaning up the mess, Pops's mess, again, my anger mitigated only by the fact that my stomach is full. Tonight, I've been fed and cared for by a mother, any mother, whether or not that mother is mine.
Quinn. It's dark by the time I leave the apartment of Nicholas Keller. It's darker than dark. It's pitch black. A starless November night, the sky an inky black. I hop on the 55 bus in Hyde Park, a good 6 or 7 miles south of the Loop. My home, at least 9 miles north of the Loop, feels far away. In another world entirely, on another planet, in another galaxy. And though I want to be there, I wonder if my home will ever again feel like home. The commute to my apartment is inauspicious even before it begins. Over an hour long, retracing the steps I made on the way to the Hyde Park flat less than an hour ago, as the sun was just starting its drop in the cold night sky. 2 buses, an L ride, and a half-mile walk on foot. But that was before. Before I had confirmation from Nicholas Keller that Esther killed his fiancée, a woman now buried beneath a bronze grave marker in an idyllic cemetery in the suburbs of Boston. What I don't get is what all these weird occurrences have in common. Esther's disappearance, the hunt for a new roommate, the petition to change her name, the death of Kelsey Bellamy. There's one thought I can't get out of my mind. Is Esther on the hunt for a new roommate because she also wants me dead? Is Esther trying to kill me? A shiver runs down my spine, and I imagine spiders scaling my vertebrae like a flight of stairs, thousands of spiders climbing the skin, their long, segmented legs stealing their way across, claws digging in, spinning webs beneath my shirt. Is Esther a murderer? Suddenly I'm scared. And still, none of this explains the identity of my dearest. Who is my dearest? Who? I demand to know, needing the answers now. I think desperately of the men Esther has brought home over the months we've been together. There weren't many, that much is for sure. There was the one who liked to cook. Some hottie with high cheekbones, a strong jawline, and large, sweet-talking eyes. There was a secret admirer who sent her flowers, 1 dozen red roses without a card. Were either of these men my dearest? I don't know. And what do any of these things have to do with me? One thing I know for sure. Something sketchy is going on. Tornado sirens start screaming silently in my ear. Air raid sirens warn me of an impending nuclear attack. Everywhere I look, I see a giant red flag. Danger, Will Robinson. I'm scared. The evening commute has come and gone. The bus isn't as crowded as it often is, which is both a blessing and a curse. I would welcome the noise for a change. Bodies pressing into mine, reeking of their noxious breath and body odors. I'd embrace it for one reason and one reason alone. The fact that there is safety in numbers. But not tonight. Tonight I am alone. I slide into a ragged seat all by my lonesome and look out the window into the shadowy night. I pull my coat around me to help keep me warm. No dice. Thanks to the LED lights on the bus, it's hard to see much of anything. The lights of the city burn ablaze in the distance, our Great Lake nothing more than a blackened abyss, a bottomless pit. I wonder what lies on the other side of that big black lake. Wisconsin? Michigan? Beyond that, there is nothing. Just darkness. But it doesn't stop me from imagining the things I can't see. I see Esther here and there, standing on the side of Lakeshore Drive, concealed behind a leafless tree. I'm overcome with this sudden, uncanny belief that she's out there, and that Esther, my dear friend Esther, is after me. I'm sure I catch sight of her in the driver's seat of another car on LSD, a red 2-door coupe, a woman who stares in through the bus window at me, her eyes menacing and hostile and mean. I spy Esther's coat at a bus stop we soar past en route to the Red Line station, her black and white checkered peacoat, her black beanie set atop a head. I twist in my seat, desperate for a glimpse of the woman who wears these things, but when I turn around, she's gone. In her place, where I imagined her to be, is coily black hair on the head of a teenage girl, a zebra-striped sweatshirt, jeans. My eyes scan the riders on the bus one by one by one. Not Esther. Not Esther. Not Esther. I mentally check them off in my mind. I inspect them all as they drop in their fare and climb on board. I do this at each bus stop, eyes scanning the hair, the eyes, for traces of Esther, reminding myself to look closely. She could be in disguise. Some middle-aged woman glares back at me and says, "What are you looking at, girl?" And I avert my eyes as she walks by in a huff and takes a seat behind me. When I don't see Esther, I tell myself that maybe she's hired someone to do away with me. It's silly, and yet it's not so silly when I put two and two together in my mind. Esther killed Kelsey, and then she found me. Kelsey, with her food allergies, was an easy target. Esther could kill her with her eyes closed and both hands tied behind her back. Step one, do away with EpiPen. Step two, peanut flour. Easy peasy lemon squeezy. But not me. I have no allergies. And now Esther is on the hunt for a new roommate, Megan from Portage Park. Her time with me is coming to an end. That's what I tell myself anyway, as I sit on the bus, all but paralyzed now in fear. Esther is trying to kill me. My rationalization leads to this. Esther has hired a hitman to kill me. She can't kill me herself, so instead she's hired someone else to do the job. Why else would she have all those withdrawal receipts from the ATM that I found in the kitchen trash can? Three receipts over three consecutive days, $500 each, totaling $1,500. Is my life worth $1,500? It is to me. What does a hitman look like, I wonder as I make my way off the bus and into the Red Line subway station. There, it's poorly lit and dingy. My view of passersby bleary and vague. Everyone is in a hurry. They whiz by me with places to go, people to see. I stand in a daze, trying hard to find my fare card, but instead appraise those around me. My feet frozen to the filthy concrete. Someone bumps into me and barks, "You're holding up traffic!" But still, I can't move. What does a hitman look like? I wonder again, growing more and more scared. Is he big, gruff, his voice guttural and rasping? WWF wrestlers come to mind. But so, too, do skinny men with facial piercings and a million tattoos, drug-addicted, emaciated men. And then there are the balding, fat men with glasses. They, too, come to mind. Is a hitman any or all of them? Some combination of these traits? Is he always a he? Or can he sometimes be a she? Is there some sort of rule for how a hitman should look or behave, or is it better that they be unassuming like the nerdy, awkward man, dull as dishwater, standing ho-hum, reading a newspaper in the center of the platform as I pay my fare and make my way down the steps? Is it possible Esther hired this man to take my life? His eyes rise up off the newspaper as I appear, and he smiles. "I've been waiting," say the eyes. I look closely for a weapon in his pocket or hand, for something that will kill. And then it comes to me. The L train will kill. That's the one thought that crosses my mind as I step foot on the platform, eyes spinning like a chameleon with 360-degree vision, making sure no one is hot on my trail. My heart beats quickly. I drop my fare card once, twice, three times before I manage to get it into the pocket of my purse. There is the occasional mishap on the train. Someone or other falls onto the electrified line or gets struck and killed by an incoming train. It's happened before. I've seen it on the news. It's not that common, but it happens. Men or women electrocuted on the third rail. Men or women run over by the train. More often than not, suicide. The CTA lines get shut down to investigate, and for the rest of the world, it's nothing more than an inconvenience. Just downright annoying and rude that some fool decides to off himself smack dab in the middle of rush hour on the city's main mode of public transportation. But that's not what I'm thinking about right now. No, Right now, I'm thinking about what it would feel like to tumble the distance, to be fried with 1,000 volts of electricity, to be flattened by one of the largest rapid transit systems in the world, to be dead. That's what I'm thinking about as I keep my distance from the man with the newspaper, the man with the tattoos, the man with the glasses and balding head, and the 50-ish woman, yes, woman, with silver in her hair. One can never be too careful of anything. What it would feel like to be dead. That's what I wonder. The red line pulls into the station and I climb on board. I stand, ready to make a run for it if need be. I could have taken a cab. Why didn't I just take a cab, I wonder. But the truth is, safety in numbers. There is safety in numbers. That's something my mother would say. Maybe she's not so daft after all. She also told me to carry mace, 1,000,000 times. I told her she was being ridiculous. A worrywart, I called her when she was terrified for me to leave the security blanket of our safe suburban life. She feared all the hooligans the city had to offer, the gangs, the high rates of crime. Relax, Mom, I told her. You're worrying for nothing. But now I'm not so sure. I want Mace. More importantly, I want my mother. Again, I go through the evidence one by one in my mind. The fact that Esther's gone missing. The notes to my dearest. The obscure phone call on Esther's phone about the missed appointment Sunday afternoon. The petition to change her name. The withdrawal receipts. The quest for a new roommate. Someone to replace me after I'm gone. Gone? Gone where? The death of Kelsey Bellamy, which, in my mind, trumps all the other evidence. Though I'm left wondering if any or all of these are genuine clues, or if they're simply red herrings. Misleading ploys meant to throw me off course. I don't know. When the train pulls into the station, there's still one more bus ride ahead. I make haste down the street and to the bus station. I thank God Almighty that the bus pulls in just as I arrive, and that I don't have to wait outside in the cold, dark night. I scramble in, up the steps, and claim a seat right behind the driver. The driver will protect me, I stupidly tell myself. He takes off before I'm fully in my seat. I almost fall from the motion. Once seated, I dig through my purse to find my keys and anything else that might be of use to protect me. A nail file, lip balm, hand sanitizer. I'm thinking ahead of next steps. When the bus pulls to my stop, I'll hurry home. Up the 3 floors of the walk-up and into apartment 304. I'll lock the door, but since Esther has keys, that will be futile. It will be of no use. Then I'll fortify the door with chairs, I decide. All the chairs I can find. The mod plaid chair, the kitchen table chairs, Esther's desk chair. I'll bolster it with the apartment sofa, too. The coffee table, a desk. Whatever I can find. But then I remember that Esther doesn't have a key to our apartment. Not anymore. Maintenance man John changed the locks. At this, I breathe a small sigh of relief, knowing I'll still bolster the door with the chairs and table anyway, just in case. I won't eat anything for fear it's been poisoned with ricin or cyanide. I decide this too. And then there's the fire escape. Should Esther opt to return the way she left, up the fire escape and through her bedroom window, back into our home? The window is closed and locked, but that doesn't mean she can't slice through the screen and break the glass with a fist. Or maybe she'll just set the whole damn building on fire. That's what I'm envisioning, our floor flat engulfed in orange flames. And then I feel it. The gentle stroking of my long blonde hair. And there, on the bus, I scream.
Alex. That night, I lie down in bed, and just as I start to drift to sleep, I awaken. That jolt of electricity that comes before sleep, the body ready to retire for the night, the mind not. Or is it the other way around? A hypnagogic jerk, a night start. That's what wakes me, or so I think. It's quiet, and then suddenly I hear the chink of glass on glass. That's what it sounds like to me. It takes a minute to get my bearings, and when I do, I figure out that the noise is coming from the window. I rise from the bed and approach the glass just in time to see a small rock get catapulted into it, its trajectory taking it from the ground to the glass. It swats the window and tumbles down, rolling along the shingles of the porch roof. I open the blinds and peer to the wilted lawn down below, and there she stands, Pearl. She's cloaked in her black and white checkered coat, the black beanie set on her head. It's murky outside tonight, making it hard to see clearly, but I see her. She's there, standing in the quiet night like a figure in a blurry photograph, hazy and imperfect, but still perfect in so many ways. She waves as I open the blinds and gaze outside, feeling more than a little bit flummoxed. Why is she here? I don't know why, but I thank the heavens that she is. All my life, I dreamed some girl would come to me in the middle of the night, and now here she is. I raise my hand and wave back, a shiftless sort of wave, though inside I feel anything but. Inside I forget the fact entirely that I was just on the cusp of sleep, brooding over Pops and an unpaid electric bill, the fact that he'd stolen my telescope, feeling sorry for myself, sulking, wanting and hoping for something other than this life. I hold up an index finger and mouth the words, 1 second, though I doubt she can see. I snatch a sweatshirt from the handle of my closet door and dash outside before she can change her mind and go. What are you doing here? I ask, my voice little more than a whisper as I meet her on the lawn. The grass is wet, covered in dew. It seeps through my gym shoes, moistening my feet, making them cold. Her hair is wet, and I want more than anything to reach out and touch it, to graze the ombre hair with my fingertips and see if the texture changes along with the tinge, gritty to coarse to syrupy and silky, like velvet. That's the way it looks to me, like velvet. It's been raining, I think, and that's why her hair is wet. But I never heard any rain. There's dew on the lawn, but the concrete of the sidewalks and the street is dry. Maybe she was swimming again, treading water in Lake Michigan. Maybe that's it. That's probably it, I decide. She was swimming. But I don't ask. I was bored, she admits. That's why she's here then. I don't know what to say to this, or what to think. How bored did she have to be to come see me? But I try not to let my self-doubt get the best of me. She's here, and that's all that matters to me. She's here. She turns and starts to walk, and like some little lost puppy, I follow. The air outside is brisk tonight, the town eerily quiet. Little more than the sound of our own footfalls fills the night, the involuntary kicking of gravel beneath our feet, the rhythmic squeak of a single shoe. There are no cars, no trains, no gulls or owls. The whole world is asleep, save for us, Pearl and me. We walk. I don't know where it is that we're going, and I don't think she knows either. As far as I can tell, we're not going anywhere. We don't say much. Sometimes that's best, so that I don't say anything stupid and mess the whole thing up. But every now and then we say something unavailing and dumb, like, "That's an ugly house," or "Looks like the streetlight is out again." Just shooting the shit, that kind of thing. But then, after we've gone halfway around the block for the second time, she says, "My folks gave me up." The words come out of nowhere, though I bet they've been dwelling there in the back of her mind for a long time now, trying to work their way out, like lab rats trying to work their way through a maze. "When I was a girl," she adds, and I put her words together in my head, her confession, "my folks gave me up when I was a girl." Admissions like this seem a lot easier in the dark, when you don't have to see the pitying look on someone else's face, a look that somehow makes you feel worse when it's supposed to make you feel better. "What do you mean, gave you up?" I ask. "Like for adoption?" "Yeah," she says. "Sorry," I say, because I can't think of anything better to say. Doesn't seem like it's my right to try and gouge out more information anyway, so I settle instead on a listless sorry, hoping that she knows I really mean it. She's not a kid. She's old enough that you'd think she might be over it by now, and yet I guess you don't ever really get over these things. It's not like I've moved past my mother's leaving me. That's the kind of pain that's more of an aching throb than a sudden sting. It goes on forever. She shrugs her shoulders and says to me, "It's okay, I'm over it." But somehow, I don't think that she is. My best guess is that she's 25, maybe 28 years old, and she's still mad about the fact that her parents gave her up for adoption. That's the thing about stuff like that. It festers. It's human nature to hold a grudge. It's hard looking forward when you have trouble figuring out what you've left behind, or rather, what's left you behind. My own mother's been gone for 13 years now, and not a day goes by that I don't have bad feelings about it. Truth be told, I'm still mad, and I think about her all the time. I'd tell Pearl about how she needs to forget the past and move forward with the future, but that's what we call the pot calling the kettle black. I'm no hypocrite. Sometimes things like that are easier said than done. "How come?" I ask her then. "How come your folks gave you up?" I can't see it, but I imagine that she shrugs. "Why does anyone give up their kids?" she wants to know. It's a rhetorical question. She's not really looking for an answer. But inside I start to come up with all sorts of replies, such as financial trouble, divorce, a young, unmarried mother, a lack of support, just some lady who didn't have a clue how to be a mom. I'm pretty sure she doesn't want to hear any of these things. She harbors a resentment in her voice. I can hear it clear as day. If anything, she wants me to tell her that folks give their kids up because they're lousy people and terrible parents, because they're just mean. But I don't have a chance to say this. "Bad girl!" she spits then, the intensity of her words making me jump. They're potent and angry, and then there, in the night air, to no one in particular, she points a rigid finger accusatorily and says again, "Bad girl! You've been a bad girl!" It's bizarre, that's for sure. Pearl's declaration, or memory, or whatever it is that just happened. It's not like I don't already know she's a tad bit loony, and this gives me further reason to question her sanity. And yet, for whatever reason, I don't. Maybe it's nice to be in the company of someone who pays no regard to the norms of society, who doesn't care what other people think. And yet, those words, that pronouncement, "bad girl," on an otherwise quiet night, stays in my mind. "You've been a bad girl." It's a slogan that sticks with her, like mine does me. "Go away, Alex. Leave me alone. Don't touch me." The night grows silent. I listen to the rhythm of our footfalls, my feet keeping pace with hers. We walk slowly, aimlessly, not even in a straight line. Ambling would be a better word. We amble down the street at night, under a canopy of stars and trees. Somewhere off in the distance, a pack of coyotes passes through a forest or field, spouting their high-frequency howls as the pack reunites for a kill. We listen, imagining a pack of coyotes stalking and surrounding a prairie dog, a cat, a squirrel. That's what they always told me, at least. "You've been a bad girl," she says again, but this time her words are quieter, told with reserve. I want to ask her if it was true, if she was a bad girl. I think that maybe it was true, but also maybe not. Maybe it was taken out of context or blown out of proportion, something along those lines. Really, all kids are bad anyway, aren't they? Self-absorbed and all that. It's in their nature. I'm guessing I probably was, and that's why my mother decided to leave. But suddenly, knowing her folks gave her up makes my mother look not quite so bad for leaving me. At least I still had Pops. She didn't take me away from Pops. "Did you just find out?" I ask. "About being given up?" But she says no, she's known for a while. "Someone told you?" I want to know, but she says, "I figured it out on my own." She started having dreams, she tells me, about another mother, another father, about fingers getting pointed at her, angry, denunciatory fingers, and those same five words repeated over and over again like a broken record. "You've been a bad girl." It was years ago, many years. She was still at home living with her folks. She told her adoptive parents about the dreams, though she didn't really need to. They'd already heard her, calling out in her sleep. They knew about the nightmares, or what she thought were nightmares at the time. Turned out they were flashbacks. She was remembering. And little by little she put the pieces together and figured it out. There was the fact, too, that she didn't look a thing like her family, all tall and thick-set with strawberry blonde hair and light green eyes. They looked nothing like her. She was upset, overcome by a sense of abandonment and sadness, whether or not she had a family who loved her. She felt hurt, rejected by the parents who gave her up. But it was more than that, too. She'd been lied to and made to look like a fool. Her adoptive family was contrite. "They were good people," she tells me then as we walk down the splintered street. "They are good people." We're closer now, moving in parallel lines. We don't touch, not intentionally, no, but every now and then the swing of her arm grazes the swing of mine. "They wanted to make it better," she tells me of her adoptive parents. She doesn't tell me their names or anything about them, but she admits that they stuffed her full of love and affection. They sent her for therapy. And at the mention of therapy, a signal goes off in my brain. Dr. Giles. "They did the best they could with what they were given, you know? I was a screwed-up kid. Still am, I guess. I made her cry a lot, my mother. I made him mad. But they were good people. They didn't yell. They didn't hit me when I was being bad. And it's not like they were just going to drive on into the next town and leave me with some new family I didn't know." "Who does that kind of thing?" she asks with a sardonic laugh. I don't say a thing. She isn't looking for me to say anything. "They were stuck with me, you know. They'd adopted me. They signed the papers and all, though still, I put them through hell. I know I did. Couldn't help it, that's just me. It's who I am. But still," she says, "when I turned 18, I took my cue and decided to leave. They didn't need me sticking around anymore, poaching on their family. It was their family anyway, not mine. I tried to find my family, she confesses. My real family, anyway. And I did, she says, her voice gloomy and withdrawn. There's a long hiatus in her admission. I think that's all she's going to say. I tried to find my family, and I did. I want to know more. I want to pry. I want to ask what happened, but I don't. I leave it at that, knowing that when she's ready, she'll tell me more. Instead, I unclasp the shark's tooth necklace from around my neck and hand it to her, for strength and protection. Right now, she needs it more than me. I can't, she says, but she does it anyway, taking the cord from my shaking hands as we continue on into the darkness of night, walking until I think I can walk no more, but even then, I don't want to go home. I tried to find my family, she says again after some time, after a long time, so long that I decided she was never going to tell me. And I did. I tracked them down. I can hear her breathing in the sleepy night, her breath weighted down like mud. It doesn't come easy. An upshot of the walking, or maybe the stress, maybe the grief. But they still didn't want me, she adds. After all those years, they still didn't want me. And my heart snaps for her, knowing what it did to me after my mother rejected me. I listen as she tells me how she found her family, but as soon as she did, they tried to elude her, to refuse her phone calls, to pay her to go away. And suddenly my mother's one single rejection doesn't seem so bad. If I saw my mother again and she refused me for a second time, I don't know what I'd do. I think I'd likely lose it.
Quinn.
Pipe down, lady,
says the bus driver, a big man with an even bigger voice. He hardly turns in his chair, just enough to see that I'm not being raped at gunpoint. But he doesn't slow down the bus. He doesn't step on the brakes or reach for his walkie-talkie doodad to call for help.
Everything okay?
He asks, his voice as apathetic as if he'd asked if I wanted fries with my meal. Behind me sits the bum who likes to touch my hair. And it's instantaneous, almost, the sense of relief. Not a killer, I tell myself. Just a creep. But the relief is short-lived. When he smiles, I see half of his teeth are missing. The rest are yellow and misshapen. He'll lose those, too. I just know it. I'm not sure I've ever looked him in the eye before, other than a sideways glance and a simple request, "Stop touching my hair, please." He'd be creepy even on a good day, but this isn't a good day. He'd be creepy if the sun was out and it was the middle of day, but this is not the middle of day, and outside the world is quiet and dark. Here and now, he's downright scary. He has a lot of hair, on his head, on his face. It's frizzed and crimped and standing on end. I can hardly see his cratered skin for all the hair. He wears a hat on top of his head, a navy-colored driving cap that doesn't do a thing to keep his ears warm. He carries with him a backpacking pack with the harness and hip belt and a trekking pole. There isn't much to his coat, a soft shell hoodie the color of mushrooms. But the size of him, big, might be enough to keep him warm. On his feet are mismatched gym shoes, a handout from some aid organization, Goodwill or the Salvation Army, I'm guessing, or a lucky dumpster dive. His hands are unwashed. He smells. He wears a lanyard around his neck with a name tag that says Sam. I'd bet my life he's not Sam. He found the name tag, or better yet, he stole it. I look behind him and realize that, save for a couple of scene-stir teens in the back of the bus, we're the only people here. They pay us no mind. They wear sunglasses at night. They send text messages to each other. They wear headphones and use words like tight and dope and tool, none of which have the same meaning as was intended by Merriam and Webster. One of the boys rises to his feet and says,
I've got a bounce.
Another says, bless up, my friend. They can't save me. No way. The rest of the bus is filled with row upon row of empty pews. No one to help. And then the creep says,
I like your hair.
As he reaches out again to touch it, and I jerk back with haste, dropping my purse so that half of its contents fall to the floor. My wallet, my makeup case, my phone. I reach my hand beneath the grimy bus seat as far as it will go to make sure I haven't managed to miss something. But my hand comes up empty. Well, empty save for the spit off someone else's chewed up gum.
It's pretty,
the creep says, and I say to the driver, let me off. I need to get off the bus. I need to get off this bus right now. While sweeping my belongings up off the dirty bus floor and into my bag. And what does the bus driver say to me?
Next stop's a half block away,
is what he says.
Unless it's an emergency, you'll just have to wait.
And then he yells at the homeless man to leave me alone, and for the next 20 seconds he does. He stops touching my hair. He leans back in his seat and stops talking to me. I grab my belongings and stand. I pull the cord for the next bus stop, grateful that it's my own. When the bus comes to a halt, I don't walk. I run. My feet pound the pavement. I'm not entirely alone on the street tonight, but I feel entirely alone. Knowing every soul I pass is a potential threat, there's no telling who's good and who's bad. Who I can trust, who I can't trust. I bypass people, those coming and going through store and restaurant doors. Women walking dogs and men with other men talking and laughing. I watch them all. I watch them all and wonder, are you the one? Are you? Are you? The question runs over and over again in my head. Has Esther hired someone to kill me? I double and triple check for cars before crossing an intersection. I sidestep street gutters and storm drains in case they've been intentionally removed so that I will plummet to my death. Can one die in a storm drain? I don't know. There's no telling what kind of accident might befall me. I avoid walking too close to buildings with window air condition units in case they might become loose and tumble down onto my head. Traumatic brain injury. That can certainly lead to death. Brain hemorrhaging. Intracranial pressure. As I leave the more bustling streets of Clark and Foster and head on to sleepy little streets like Farragut, I'm entirely overcome with the creeps, the willies, the heebie-jeebies. It's entirely possible I wet my pants. I want to go home. I want to be home. And not in the walk-up apartment I share with Esther. I want to be in my mother and father's home with my parents and my sister, Madison. I want to click my feet together and say it 3 times, there's no place like home. But I don't go home. The wind whips through the trees, tousling my hair, blowing it before my eyes so that I can't see. It wraps around my eyes like a blindfold, inhibiting my vision. But just as I'm about to panic, the wind leaves the hair, slinking down my coat, copping a feel of the bare skin. I shudder, wanting to scream at the wind. There's the sound of traffic in the distance. A man in a 3-piece suit stops and attempts to ask me for directions.
Can you tell me how to get to Catalpa?
He asks, but I tell him to go away too. I don't know, I say. 3 or 4 times I say it, in rapid progression. I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. The words all blended together into an amalgam. The man gives me a dirty look and disappears into thin air. And that's when I hear my name, hissed on the breath of the wind. Quinn. Quinn, says the wind, or at least that's what I hear. And then a laugh, a gut-wrenching laugh. From the shadows of the trees he appears. Him. The yellow, misshapen teeth, the shaggy hair. He stands close, reaching his dirty hand out to me, trying to touch my hair. I draw back quickly, tripping over the sidewalk and falling to the ground. What do you want with me? I cry from the cold concrete. He doesn't answer, but instead reaches out that dirty hand and tries to help me to my feet. I resist. I don't want to touch the hand. I don't want to touch him. I push myself up off the ground, cutting a palm on the rugged surface as I do. In the darkness, it starts to bleed. I rub at the injured hand, begging again. Just leave me alone! I turn to run, but suddenly his hand is on my arm, holding tight, curtailing the blood supply. Let go of me! I scream. But he doesn't. Of course he doesn't. I'm a wiggly worm on the end of a fishing hook, kicking and screaming for dear life. And then there, in his hand, he brandishes something. A weapon. The light from a street lamp a solid 20 feet away casting a faint glow on the shiny matter. Steel, maybe? Or maybe metal? Is it a gun? A knife? I don't know. I tug at my arm. I try hard to pull away. I begin to cry. Don't hurt me, I beg. Please don't hurt me. His hand is hurting my arm, making it ache, the ligaments and muscles stretching in ways they aren't meant to go. But all he does is laugh. There are 3 million people in all of Chicagoland, and not a single one of them with me on this street tonight. I should scream. That's what I should do. Help me! Help me! But my voice is nothing more than a whisper. I open my mouth to scream, but nothing comes out.
Hurt you, he says. I ain't trying to hurt you.
I say it again.
Let me go, let me go, let me go.
You left this on the bus, lady,
he tells me.
That's all. You left this on the bus.
And then I see the item in his hand. It makes a ting, a slight noise hardly audible over the sound of my cry. Not a gun, not a knife, but a phone. Esther's phone, which must have fallen out when I dropped my bag under a seat where I couldn't reach. As I snatch the phone from his hand, he lets go of my arm and I draw back quickly, tripping again over my own 2 feet. But this time I don't fall. An incoming text message has just arrived. I don't need a password to read this one. There it is. Right on the display screen. Payback's a bitch, it says.
Alex. We're sitting on the dusty, dirty floor of the old tract home. Homes like these, there's nothing unique about them. About 100 of these very same homes popped up almost overnight, 50 or 60 years ago, so that this one is the same as the next, as the next. As the next. They're all the same, every single one of them, except that one may be brown and one may be blue. But they're all ugly and stodgy and just plain blah. Just like my very own home across the street from here. It's ugly too. It's dark outside, still night. We walked until we could walk no more, and then, instead of going back home and to bed, I came here, to this home, to Pearl's home. Tell me about this ghost, Pearl says. She sits on the floor before me, her legs pulled up into her. How I came to be here, I don't know. I just did. She folds her hands into her lap. The scintilla of light that sneaks in through the edges of the boarded-up window reflects off the pointed triangular tooth, my necklace. My shark's tooth necklace, which lies over the neckline of her own T-shirt. It's dark in here. Between the boarded-up windows and the lack of lights, I can no longer tell day from night. I've lost all sense of time. Pearl sits just 2 feet away, staring at me, until I can hardly dredge up my own name or the reason why I'm here. What ghost? I ask. Though, of course, I know what she means. She looks a bit tuckered out, tired. I imagine it's not easy sleeping on a hard floor, spending your days roaming some small town streets. Just passing through, she'd said, and I wonder how long until she leaves. Not that I want her to leave, because I don't. But I wonder when the day will come that I'll show up at this godforsaken home, and she won't be here. You told me this house was haunted, she says. She won't believe any of the stories I'm about to tell. I don't even believe them. But it's conversation, small talk. And anyway, what's more important than the ghost, or this stupid idea of a ghost that half the town has conjured up, is the little girl she used to be. The rest of it is just for fun. People like to make themselves feel scared. They like to tell the tales to scare other people, too. But it's all just make-believe. Genevieve has been dead for years now, since before I was even born. What I know is hearsay. As the story goes, she drowned in some hotel bathtub while her mother was in the neighboring room, attending to a baby, incognizant of the way 5-year-old Genevieve slipped beneath the water and drowned. There was no scream like people do when they're hurt or in danger, but rather a silent death, the sagging underwater and drifting off to sleep. She never cried out. She never gasped for air. That's how the story goes. In time, the accounts of Genevieve's death became romanticized, to say the least. A little girl immersed in a cornucopia of bubble bath and soap suds, so that all that remained above water were a few random strands of brunette hair. They were in a lavish hotel room, on vacation. The description of the death scene was redolent. The puce-colored bubbles with their raspberry sorbet scent, the girl's creamy skin, reddened by the warmth of the water, though none of the people telling the tale were there to see what it is that they describe. The few random bubbles, silvery bubbles floating in the air, sticking to the bathtub tiles. Genevieve had drowned, forgotten in the bathtub thanks to a little moppet in the adjoining room, her sister, only a year or two old at the time, who had fallen from the bed and cried, taking her mother's attention away from the girl in the bathtub. It was too expensive to ship the body across state lines, or so they say. Those neighbors who are old enough to remember the day the family car pulled into the driveway of the yellow home, the 3-foot corpse tucked away in the trunk to skirt whatever legalese was required of moving a body from here to there. Neighbors say they'll never forget the way they hovered in the cracked concrete driveway, waiting to help lift the rudimentary wooden casket from the trunk and into a hole they dug up at the cemetery in town. The news of Genevieve's death had already arrived, leading the way into town well before her corpse. People were shattered. Little girls weren't supposed to die. All that was left behind was Genevieve's ghost, said to haunt people even in sleep, their dreams filled with bathwater spilling over the sides of a tub, a little girl like a seraph, dead. Her skin, ashen and white, wings sprouting from her body. Her hair, jet black and wet. I don't believe any of those things. Genevieve, I say to Pearl. That's her name. The girl's name who died. The ghost's name, supposedly. It's pretty, she tells me. It's a pretty name. It is. And she died? She did. Here? Asks Pearl, doing a sweep of the room with her slim arm, but I shake my head no. I follow the path of her arm anyway, to the shadows that linger in each and every corner of the room, the spider webs that hang from the ceiling like lace. I have half a mind to excuse myself and come back with a mop and a vacuum, to clean this place up. I think that I would do that for Pearl. I would make this place somewhat more livable and nice. I couldn't fix everything, no, of course not. But I could sweep the floors and dust the webs, that kind of thing. She shouldn't have to stay here in this hellhole. The cold room has drifted to hot, thanks to the heater. Hot enough that Pearl has removed her coat and my sweatshirt, and sits beside them on the floor, in a thin cotton shirt and her jeans. Her arms move with the grace of a ballerina, moving through their positions in the air. I want to ask her if she ever danced, if she ever took ballet classes, what the nature is of her relationship with Dr. Giles. But I don't. Of course I don't. None of these things are my business. Everyone has their own secrets. She doesn't ask me mine, so I won't ask her hers. Though I'd tell her, of course. I'd tell her anything and everything she wanted to know. We're friends, right? You and I, we're friends. No, I say then, focusing on the conversation at hand. Not here. Genevieve didn't die here. And then I go on to tell her about the family vacation, about the lavish hotel, the cornucopia of bubble bath and soap suds and all that stuff. I watch as her face saddens with my narrative of little Genevieve's death. She didn't know how to swim? She asks me, and I shrug my shoulders and say, apparently not. Because, of course, if she did know how to swim, she would have held her breath underwater and not inhaled deeply and let the water fill her lungs. There is speculation that Genevieve tried to stand up in the bathtub and hit her head on the ceramic tile, causing her to become unconscious before she drowned. That's just one hypothesis. No one was there to say for sure. No one saw her die. There's also the assumption that she was playing a game, trying to see how many seconds she could hold herself underwater, but the water won out in the end. Oxygen deprivation, they think, summoning a breath reflex, the body's natural need to breathe even when submerged in soapy water, filling the stomach first, and then the lungs, with fluid. Hundreds of thousands of people die each year from drowning. Of these, a huge percent are 5 years old or less, like Genevieve was. People can drown in anything from bathtubs to toilets to puddles. I think of Pops drinking himself nearly to death. He's liable one day to die in his own bottle of beer. I wonder what happens when you drown, Pearl says. I wonder if it hurts. She looks at me then, her sad eyes wanting to know. I don't know, I say, but I bet it does. I bet it's scary, not being able to breathe. These aren't the words she wants to hear, I know that. She wants me to tell her that Genevieve merely closed her eyes and drifted off to sleep, that Genevieve didn't know any better, that one minute she was blowing bubbles in a bathtub, and the next she was dead. In the afterlife, heaven, at the pearly gates and all that. She never knew she was dying. That's what Pearl wants to hear. But for some reason or